in the final estimation, the important thing about being involved in the Judeo-Christian tradition is not what one believes about the tradition, but that one tells the stories of the tradition. So that it's not what one believes, let us say, about biblical narratives, but the fact that one is part of the community that keeps on telling them. That's really identifies you as in being part of that tradition.
Religion and language, next on Soundings.
The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future, with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
The National Humanities Center now presents a discussion of religion and language with two scholars in residence at the center, John Wall, who teaches English at North Carolina State University, and D.W. Robertson, professor of English emeritus at Princeton University. Professor Wall specializes in the literature of the English Renaissance. He is a priest in the Episcopal Church. Professor Robertson is an authority on medieval English literature and society. Why is the concept of the word important in religious language? And when I say the word, I mean the word with a capital W.
Well, of course, the notion of the word derives most immediately from the beginning of John's Gospel, which starts, "In the beginning was the Word," and goes on to say that the Word became flesh. That's the way John leads into his presentation of the earthly career of Jesus. But the notion of a relationship between God and speaking, between God and language, is something that's really very, very essential to the Judeo-Christian tradition from the first words of the first page in the Bible. In the beginning, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. As a matter of fact, some biblical theologians develop their sense of biblical theology through a very careful examination of the way in which the Bible uses language, the kinds of language it uses, and the situations in which it uses that language. The God in someone has said that in the Ten Commandments, the prohibition against graven images, that language in a sense escapes that restriction. And so it seems a very essential and very basic part of the Judeo-Christian or biblical tradition that the way that somehow the nature of the God who is presented in that tradition is tied up in the nature of speaking, that human speech is perhaps the best analogy for, or the best metaphor for describing the relationship between God and man.
Well, is it not a fact that in some religions in the West, it is forbidden to say the name of God?
I assume you're referring to the fact that in the Hebrew Scriptures, God's name appears as four letters with no vowels, and nobody knows exactly how to pronounce that, and it isn't pronounced. In English translations of the Bible, when you see the English word God in the Old Testament, what lies behind that is that group of four letters, which is known as the Tetragrammaton. And what appears in the English text is the Lord, what is being translated there is the Hebrew Elohim, which is a euphemism or a circumlocution for the divine name, so that if one were reading the Hebrew Bible out of that tradition, one would say the Lord every time the Tetragrammaton or the name of God appeared.
Well, for many years in the early Christian tradition, creation itself was said to be the voice of God speaking to man, whereas language is the voice of man speaking to man. So that I think people found that creation was the book of God's work, which they could read much in the same way that they read the book of God's word.
One of the things that intrigues me, especially in this, is in the Hebrew Bible, the word that is used for the divine speaking is a word which means both speaking and acting simultaneously. When I say the man walked across the road, I can say that whether the man in fact walked across the road or not, but in biblical terms, when God says it, it is. God said, let there be light, and there was light, and there's no, I mean, the speaking is God's instrumentality. It is the speaking that makes it so. And that kind of relationship between speaking and doing is one of the ways in which the Bible manifests this particular relationship. It has been said that for example, that in the final estimation, the important thing about being involved in the Judeo-Christian tradition is not what one believes about the tradition, but that one tells the stories of the tradition. So that it's not what one believes, let us say, about biblical narratives, but the fact that one is part of the community that keeps on telling them, that's really identifies you as in being part of that tradition.
John, I wonder if you could say a word or two about the opening of the Gospel of St. John.
Erasmus, when he translated, when he produced one of the first great works of Renaissance humanist scholarship, his 16th century Greek translation, or 16th century edition of the Greek text, Erasmus then produced a Latin translation of his Greek edition. And when he got to the beginning of John's Gospel, he translated the phrase that we think of it as, in the beginning was the Word, instead of translating it in principio erat verbum, he had translated it in principio erat sermo. In the beginning was not the Word, but the speaking. In the beginning was the speaking. And in that, I think he picks up just this notion, this Old Testament notion that God's speaking is instrumental. It's God's speaking that creates. It's God's speaking that makes all things new.
Professor Robertson, how does religious language shape belief, for instance, in the context of the Middle Ages?
Well, in the Middle Ages, there was much the same kind of difficulty for many years with the scriptural text as there is today. There was no really standard text of the Bible until the scholars at the University of Paris in the 13th century produced a standard text of St. Jerome's Vulgate Bible. And the fathers sometimes use other texts of the Bible, and these are preserved in their commentaries.
When you say the fathers, you mean who?
St. Augustine, for example. And St. Jerome would, of course, not have used a revised text of his own Bible. So that there's sometimes a variety of versions of the same scriptural passage circulating all at the same time during the course of the Middle Ages. I don't think that this produced much confusion because people were aware of the situation, but it sometimes had an effect on figurative language. Later on, there are differences between the Vulgate Bible or the Douay translation of the Bible and the King James Bible, and these sometimes deeply affect attitudes. For example, there is a difference between peace on earth and goodwill toward men, which is from the King James Bible, and peace on earth to men of goodwill, which is in the Douay Bible. And whether you believe in peace on earth and goodwill toward men, or peace on earth to men of goodwill, makes quite a difference.
Does it make any difference in the way the Bible is translated, or did it make any difference in the way that the Bible was translated, the whole business of him and her, and male and female, and the issue of equality, and the issue of the status of women, for instance? Is that an issue of language, or is that an issue of doctrine insofar as the way we have received the scriptures, the way they've been translated?
Well, I don't think that was an issue that has disturbed anyone until fairly recently.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that in the past this has even occurred to people.
So the implication here is that religious language is nearly always going to be figurative.
That's right.
It's not going to be a correspondence.
That's right. St. Augustine says himself that God is ineffable, and if God is ineffable, therefore one cannot say anything about him. And he says that this quibble, and that's what he thinks it is, should be simply disregarded.
Professor Robertson, what about the practice of religion? How concretely does religious language affect the way people practice religion? The singing of hymns, for instance, the memorizing of doctrine, that kind of thing.
Well, I think the language of the Bible always has something to do with people's attitudes. There are a great many people who have been brought up on the King James Bible, and they regard newer versions of the scriptural text with a certain amount of discomfort. After all, if when you were a child you memorized Psalms in the King James Version, you're not likely to be pleased by revisions in the text. But those revisions in the text, on the other hand, make things more comprehensible to certain other people. St. Augustine, in discussing this matter, points out that the spiritually significant elements in the Bible are the things themselves that are spoken about and not the words, so that the actual words don't really make much difference. That is, what is said is just as valid in one language as it is in another, and when language changes, it doesn't matter if the scriptural text changes with it.
How much has religious language changed since, say, the time of the King James Bible? Is it as a broad a generalization as the way the language itself has changed?
Well, I think you'd better ask John about that.
I think that since the King James Bible was printed in 1611, our whole sense of language, I think, has changed, I think, fairly dramatically. And it seems to me that the kinds of, many of the controversies that swirl around modern translations of the Bible or liturgies in contemporary language reflect that. From the perspective of those who are engaged in these activities, preparing contemporary language translations of the Bible or of other religious documents, this is part of an ongoing process that is profoundly necessary. The Gerhard von Rad, who one of the most intriguing of Old Testament theologians, said that once, that when the father in a Jewish household takes up his staff and puts on his sandals and leads his family in the Passover rite, telling the story of the Passover, and in a way reenacting that story, that there's a very profound sense in which for him that story is present now in the moment of his doing it, at least in terms of its effects, at least in terms of renewing the relationship with the God who led Israel out of Egypt in the first place.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
You are listening to a discussion of religious language with two scholars in residence at the National Humanities Center. John Wall of North Carolina State University specializes in the literature of the English Renaissance. D.W. Robertson, professor of English emeritus at Princeton University, is an authority on medieval English literature. The discussion resumes now with Professor Robertson.
John, isn't part of this problem a problem of eloquence? It's traditionally been thought that religious language should be eloquent in such a way as to move people to action. And people have different ideas about what is eloquent. That is, some people think of the King James Bible as being eloquent and are not moved much by the newer translations, and other people find the King James Bible difficult and are moved by some of the newer translations. And I think that perhaps taste has a great deal to do with this.
Of course, of course. There are biblical passages. I am, as a person who spends a lot of time teaching Shakespeare and Spenser and Milton, I'm certainly not one to in any way denigrate the quality of the language of any of the religious texts presented at that time. And certainly one of the situations we are now in, let's say in the Episcopal Church, is one in which the full range of language resources from the very beginning up to the present is open, is an option, is among the possibilities one can read from the King James in the same service in which one reads from the New English Bible. Some people say that makes for a kind of liturgical anarchy, and they're uncomfortable with that. Other people find it, as you say, very enriching to have this range of possibilities. For someone who is very conscious of the need to for religious language to continue to speak to the present, language from the past to speak to the present, I think people who find themselves in that position feel that it is part of the living out of their responsibility to see that language speaks in that those words are spoken in the language of now, of the present moment.
Professor Robertson, I'd like to look at the thing historically. How, for instance, in the Middle Ages, or as English evolved from the Middle Ages into Elizabethan English and then into modern English, how did a typical member of the clergy respond to changes in language, making certain all the while that the belief remained constant?
Well, in the Middle Ages, sermons were generally preserved in Latin, but always preached in the vernacular, that is, in the later Middle Ages especially.
Did that allow for a good deal of flexibility in the way they were preached?
The same sermon could be preached by a preacher in England and by a preacher in France, one in French and one in English. And even in England, a preacher in the north of England was likely to speak a kind of English that would not be understood very well in the south of England. And I don't think that this disturbed anyone very much, because the spiritually significant parts of the Bible have to do with the things that are mentioned in the Bible and not simply with the words. So that it didn't really matter if you took a sermon by, let's say, St. Caesarius of Arles, whose sermons were very popular, or St. Augustine. It didn't matter whether you preached it in English or French or in Northern English or in Southern English. It would say practically the same thing.
I want to ask you about the importance of religious language today, and let me put it to you in the form of this question. How literate are people generally today, would you say, in terms of religious language? How sensitive to it are they? Professor Wall?
That's a very complex question. The reason and it's very possible to be very despairing. One of the things that I do is teach a course sometimes in biblical backgrounds of English literature to students who come from Bible Belt, North Carolina, And one of the interesting things is that one would expect them to know a great deal about the Bible and to know certain things about certain fundamental Christian doctrines from their upbringing. And quite frequently, they do not. We are in a situation in which there is an enormous amount of very complex and very sophisticated scholarship going on about the Bible and about liturgics and about the history of theology. A great deal of attempts to, if you will, for better or for worse, translate or to rethink Christian formulations of belief in terms that seem to be more the terms in which we think, or at least to understand more clearly the terms in which these doctrines or beliefs or statements were originally cast. And on the other hand, there seems to be a widening gulf between people who are engaged in this kind of very highly specialized, often very technical, scholarly activity, and the masses of people whose biblical or religious literacy seems to be fairly low. There's an old joke about a woman who accosted her priest on the way out of church after he'd been reading from the New English Bible, and she said, "Father, if King James English was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for me." You know, now that it's a joke, but it does raise, seems to me, a kind of issue. The kind of responses that one could depend upon maybe a few generations ago are not there anymore. And I think one of the things that happens is that when people do respond on a sort of mass level to religious language, they respond in a way that I'm at least very uncomfortable with. A biblical language or a use of the Bible or the tradition of the church in ways that I simply don't recognize as being part of the tradition as I understand it.
You have just mentioned the King James Bible, and you've been talking about that. You've both mentioned it several times. What do you say to the claim by some religious, by the fundamentalists, that the King James Version of the Bible is inspired, it's infallible?
That kind of question makes me uneasy, and I'll tell you why. There's part of the problem is that, in fact, the Bible is what the church says it is. We consider certain books of the Bible to be canonical and authentic because, at a point in the along the way in the development of the Christian church, certain writings were decided sort of by vote. I mean, the point is what. Works are you? What are you reading in your church? And so, by a process over a good many years, what we think of as the authentic canon of Scripture sort of developed through time. Many other works were written at the same time as some of the works in the New Testament.
Well, if this is a man-made process, how is it that one can claim that it is infallible and inspired?
One can claim that if one is part of a community of belief which affirms, let's say in the case of the Bible, that the development of the Bible as we know it was not merely a human activity, but a human activity with some help. And the difficulty, and I think it explains part of the difficulty that what are known as the traditionally mainstream Christian churches have in dealing with the fundamentalists is that it raises the question, what's the difference between our faith and our sense of the Bible as inspired, or the relationship between the Bible and the divine word, and theirs?
Professor Wall, the role of revelation in religious language is a sticky issue. Historically, traditionally, I suppose one could say that the role of revelation is no longer, that it doesn't play that much of a part anymore. And yet, somehow or other, that must bear on religious language.
Well, there is certainly a sense in which, at least according to, let's say, Anglican or Roman Catholic tradition, the Bible is closed. There's a sense in which something is over. And yet there is at the same time, part of the what Christians are about is a future promise, and about the incorporation of people now into the I mean, in remembering what was and in experiencing the promise now and in looking forward to a promise to come. Now, whether that is revelation, I mean, that's a hard word. It sounds like sort of that you could have something that you could add to the Bible. And I don't think anybody's interested, at least not in sort of the mainstream churches, in adding anything to the Bible. But there is also this sense of the openness and the livingness of the Word, that the somehow human language, under the right circumstances, used in the right way, in relationship to the stories from the past, in some way, if one is part of a community of faith, puts one in touch with the real essence of that faith. And so one lives now in light of that and in expectation of future fulfillment.
Professor Robertson?
On a simpler level, in As You Like It by William Shakespeare, the exiled Duke goes out into the forest and finds sermons and stones, books in the running brooks, and good in everything. That is, there is a kind of revelation in the world around you all the time.
Professor Wall, what about the impact or the effect of biblical translation, biblical scholarship on religious language? Is that something that people need to be worried about?
I'm convinced that baptism, if you will, does not necessitate decapitation. I mean, as someone who is part of a community of faith, one who feels that the talents that I have and the talents that all of us have are gifts to be used, and that in point of fact, not using them has pretty serious consequences, pretty serious negative consequences. The gist of biblical scholarship or historical scholarship, the is in fact to, or at least in my experience, gets us closer to the thing itself. If there's anything we know, it's that language changes over time, and so the words that seem to come to us meaning something to us, they make sense to us, may in fact have meant when they were first written something very, very different. And so it seems to me that the processes of scholarship are absolutely essential for us to know what it is we're reading, for us to know what it is that we are professing when we use the traditional creeds of the church to profess our faith. So scholarship into the history of all the Christian documents and the history of the church as an institution is absolutely essential for the church now.
Professor Robertson?
I think we all ought to be grateful to scientific philologists and linguists who work very hard on the scriptural text in order to bring us more accurate translations. On the other hand, we should also realize that philologists, like other human beings, make mistakes, so that sometimes we can be just a little skeptical about changing basic doctrines on the basis of philological discoveries. From a purely Christian point of view, in the long run, I think we should assume that the translation of the scriptural text that we get is always providential.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the Center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to join me for Soundings, the Center's radio program. The topic this week on Soundings is religion and language. a conversation with two authorities on literature who will discuss biblical language and translations. I hope you'll listen this week for Soundings.